Blog Talk Radio.
Well, good morning, everybody, on this Sunday morning here. I'd like to welcome to the show Mr. Chris Risley. He is the CEO of a leading cybersecurity firm out in the Bay Area in San Francisco called Bastille Inc. Chris, thank you for being on our show this morning, especially on a weekend. We appreciate it. Let's go ahead and get started, please.
Sure.
Well, first of all, we've done some snooping on here on the web. We haven't done any background checks or anything like that, but, you know, we looked at your LinkedIn profile and, you know, and we've, you know, kind of Googled you a little bit here and there to kind of see, like, what you've been up to. Tell us about your career and how you got started in cyber and how you ended up where you are today.
Well, this is my ninth venture-backed company. I took one public, sold six to public companies, and including the one I took public, and sold two to private companies. And I'm working with Bastille for the last several years. Several of those companies have been security companies. The company I ran prior to this was Defense.net, which created a cloud environment to protect organizations and agencies from DDoS attacks. And we sold that to F5 Networks. And then a year or two later, some of the venture capitalists that backed Bastille asked me to come in to focus the company on the huge opportunity in RF security. But, and by RF, I mean radio frequency security. So anyway, I got to Bastille. The thing I found exciting about Bastille was you and I know, and you've probably interviewed 100 companies that think about security on the wired network. And that's an important area of security. But as much bandwidth as you might have going in and out of a building over your internet connection, there's several times that much bandwidth going in and out of your building over radio frequency. Cell phones, Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, lots of other signals that leak out of your building, and nobody's paying attention to those. So here was a company which had radio experts looking at how can you make your airspace, your RF airspace, as secure as your network. And that seemed to me being an exciting area, and it's turned out to be, especially in the last couple of years.
Okay, excellent. Now, how did you get the name Bastille? What is the significance of that name or the origin of that name?
The company was founded with the name Bastille a year before I joined it, so I wasn't in those discussions, but Bastille is a fortress in France. It's famous because the French celebrate Bastille Day, and I guess the founders thought that would be a good name because it's a fortress.
Excellent. Now, how big is Bastille? Employee-wise, do you have other offices worldwide? Or
we have offices across the U.S. We haven't gone international yet. As you're developing a product, you want to have lots of close interactions with your customers. And so we began in the States, and we've got offices in San Francisco, California, Santa Cruz, California, Atlanta, Georgia, Clifton Forge, Virginia, and Herndon, Virginia. And then, of course, we've got some salespeople in other locations.
Okay, excellent. Now, let's do a deeper dive into Bastille. Can you provide an overview of what you guys do in your products, this radio frequency thing? That was a very interesting to me when I was reading your website. Can you do a deeper dive into that, please?
Sure. So people think a lot about security on the wired network. You know, companies and agencies and organizations spend hundreds of thousands of dollars or millions of dollars to make sure that they know what's going on their wired network, what data is leaving the building, who's connected to whom, what data is flowing between systems. Because radio frequency transmissions are invisible, nobody pays attention to them at all. What Bastille does is it provides corporations and organizations and agencies a system which puts sensors around the building. They look like Wi-Fi access points. But what they do is they monitor all the radio frequency traffic in your facility, every transmitter in your facility, and they tell you, is it transmitting? What other devices in the building is it connected with? Is it connected to any devices outside the building? It gives you the same kind of situational awareness about your radio frequency airspace that you have about what's going on your network. So we try to take an invisible thing and make it visible and help people enforce their security policies on those invisible devices.
Go ahead.
I think you were going to ask me a better question than I was going to answer. So.
Oh no. Well, what's the technology that drives behind all this? Can you go in a little bit more detail if it's not too confidential?
No, that we talk about quite a bit of this. So we have 27 patents. That address a lot of aspects of this. The underlying technology is there are now made software-defined radios. Years ago, when you bought a radio, it might have a little dial on it that you twist up and down to change frequency, and it might have other technology to receive a particular kind of signal, an FM signal or an AM signal or whatever. But now there are chips made called SDR, software-defined radio chips, that allow you to use software to tell this device what frequencies it should listen to and what protocols it should be decoding. And we've got a team of experts that figure out what those things are and provide that information to our system. So, and by the way, we were really lucky when we started the company. It happened to be the same year that DARPA, the Defense Research Agency, ran the DARPA Spectrum Challenge. So the DARPA Spectrum Challenge was, DARPA ran another challenge before that, which is pretty famous, which was the DARPA Autonomous Vehicle Challenge. And places like Stanford and MIT, they all built autonomous vehicles that were, the contest was to drive across a desert and have the vehicle controlling itself entirely. And it was a race to get to the other side. And that got quite a bit of press because people are interested in autonomous vehicles. A year or two later, they ran this DARPA Spectrum Challenge. And in that case, the DARPA Spectrum Challenge was to get signals across airspace, which was concurrently being jammed by DARPA and by your competitors. And 90 teams entered, teams from Georgia Tech and MIT and Stanford and some big companies. There was an entry from Boeing, for example. 90 teams entered, and we were able to hire one guy from each of the top four teams. So DARPA really brought together all the great radio people in the country, gave us a chance to recruit them as a group to really kick off the expertise on our team. So we've got a team of experts that understand what radio protocols are and how they're transmitted. And in a building, one of the most important things we do is locate these devices. So we find, first we discover there's a transmitter there, and then we figure out where it's located. And to do that, you need to know a lot about how radio signals bounce off walls and are attenuated by trying to go through walls, et cetera, so that you can come up with an accurate location for each transmitter in the facility. And by transmitter, I might mean the cell phone in your pocket, the Fitbit on your wrist, maybe you're somebody that needs a hearing aid. All hearing aids these days connect to, by Bluetooth, to telephones or to cell phones. So there's all sorts of devices in your building. And honestly, when a customer has us install our technology or uses one of our portable kits, they're amazed at how many different transmitters are in their facilities. And of course, they're particularly interested in the ones that they didn't put there themselves. The company started out using software-defined radios, and then we wrote a bunch of protocol decoders. Now, when I say a decoder, I don't mean that we decrypt the payload in these messages. We don't. We don't decrypt payloads, but we look at all the information in the protocol that helps us know what devices are connecting to what devices. In the same way that people that watch the network, they aren't seeing the encrypted content, but they are seeing which devices are connected to which devices and which devices are sending information out of the building. We do the same thing, but for the radio protocols on the wired network, of course, they're using IP protocols, internet protocols, but in airspace, they're using lots of other protocols, Zigbee protocols, Bluetooth protocols, Bluetooth low energy, Wi-Fi, cellular, and we see all those transmitters and decode them enough to know who those transmitters are talking to, and that allows the organization to enforce policies. And our organizations have lots of different policies. A common one is there are certain areas, maybe part of the research department or the boardroom, where there are just no transmitters allowed in there at all because they want to have confidential conversations. And we have the ability to detect whether a transmitter is in that area. If somebody accidentally carries their cell phone in their pocket or their purse, we're able to tell the chairman in that meeting that there's a cell phone in the room, and they can stop the meeting until the device gets removed. That turns out to be very important to enterprises, to some organizations. News organizations are concerned about that because they need to protect sources. And of course, there's defense locations and also government locations that they need to keep secure. And those kinds of organizations become our customers.
Okay, excellent. Now, how does the field provide full visibility into the RF devices as they enter and exit in like brick and mortar office buildings?
That's an interesting way you ask the question, and I'll answer it a little bit differently, which is there are lots of kinds of things designed to detect stuff going in and out. So we've all gone to places, courthouses and things, where you have to walk through a magnetometer, and sometimes those magnetometers will pick up a cell phone because it's got enough mass in it. But some cell phones are all plastic, and the magnetometers don't pick them up. Either way, there's this going in and out part, and that's important if your policy is absolutely no devices in here. A lot of our customers are concerned that somebody brings in a cell phone and has it turned off, and then once they get in the building, they get access to some kind of secure information, they turn their cell phone on. And if you're just detecting at the exit and entry, you never know about that. But we detect it because as soon as it comes on, it becomes a dot on the floor plan that the security team can see. And if the security team wants to, they can also get an alert when a dot occurs that they haven't previously approved that device. So we do detect when a device enters the building, but I'd say it's more important to our customers that we detect when devices come in off and get turned on because there's some reason they got turned on.
Okay. Now, tell me about your customer base profile. Who is your target market? Really, who is your sweet spot?
First couple of years that we were in the market, most of our customers were government customers, Department of Defense, Department of Homeland Security, and intelligence agencies. That's changed, especially in the last year when, actually, the first thing is, it's been surprising to me. You and I have often heard of situations in which private industry is years ahead of whatever the government's doing. But RF security, radio frequency security, is an area where the government was way ahead of private industry. When we talk to the chief information security officers at big corporations, they said, well, that's interesting, but we don't have any vulnerabilities in RF. That's not a problem for us. When we talked to government, they were very aware that they had vulnerabilities in RF, and they were trying to solve the problem. So the first couple of years, our customers were almost entirely government. But in the last year or so, more and more Fortune 100 companies have been coming to us. And part of that is they've been hiring security people out of the government. So they've been hiring people out of NSA or other big organizations in the government that are highly concerned about security. And those people brought with them the knowledge of radio frequency threats. So inside these major organizations that have lots of secrets to keep. Sometimes they're technical secrets. Sometimes they're just making sure that the information about last quarter's earnings doesn't come out until the moment of the announcement. So the last couple of days, they are very concerned that a leak doesn't happen and people make insider trades against their stock. So I'd say today are the sweet spots are parts of the government which have policies about security, major corporations, especially wanting to protect their data centers, both the data centers they run for themselves and sometimes data centers that they run for as a cloud service, and also major banks. Major banks have lots of customer secrets to protect, and they want to make sure that they've got systems there to let them know if information's leaking out.
Okay. Do you have any customer success stories that you want to share with us?
Well, yes. I can tell you some customer stories. I won't identify where they are. A funny thing about the security business is that it's in a lot of businesses, you try to get your early customers to tell other people or to tell the press about what they did with your product. That's very hard to do in security because security people don't want to reveal the methods by which they protect themselves. And it's a frustration for every security company's CEO, but at least I've got some anecdotes to tell you. So we went into a large facility, a facility actually that is called a SCIF, a Secure Compartmentalized Information Facility in the government. And this one's very large. It's bigger than the Superdome. And in there, they had a no transmitters policy. That was the order from the top, and that's what they thought they had. They were so concerned to make sure that that was a well-enforced policy that they bought our product, and they thought that
Hello, Chris?
Hi.
Hello, Chris. Yes, our last question was, about your customer success stories, I think.
Sure. Okay, I'll start that one again. So there's a large government facility that has a no devices policy, and they thought that they would probably find one device a month where somebody accidentally brought their cell phone in their purse and forgot to leave it in their car in the parking lot. But they were so concerned about their no transmitters policy that they bought Bastille and had the system installed. And as soon as we turned it on, we immediately saw in a room up 100 yards down the hall, two Fitbits. And the security officer that was with us runs down the hall, goes into the room and announces, we found two Fitbits in this room. If you've got a Fitbit on, raise your hand. And two ladies raised their hands. The first lady then produces a letter which says she's allowed to have this Fitbit for health reasons. So it turns out that though they thought they had a zero tolerance for transmitters policy, they had exceptions like this letter. And the other lady had seen the first lady wearing a Fitbit and thought, well, I guess Fitbits are okay in here because, you know, this other lady gets to wear one. So it turns out that your employees reinterpret your rules and based on what they see in the world. And everybody was innocent here in the sense that they weren't trying to sneak out government secrets. The policy just happened to be different than what the commanding officer thought it was, and also employees interpreted it differently. Now it turns out that because they have Bastille, they're now able to have a much more sophisticated policy where if you have a new health device which is on the allowed list, you can go to the guard station the first time you bring it in, and the guard station will put it near one of our sensors. And our sensor will record the identity of that device. And from then on, you're allowed to wear it in the facility because it's an authorized device. And then the, what the guard station is doing now is they've turned Bastille in such a way that they only see devices which they haven't already authorized, because the authorized devices they're okay with. And so each time a new device comes in that isn't presented to them but actually goes into the facility, they pick it up. And it's turned out that they've been finding about a device a day, even though they thought they would find a device a month. So that's what happens in some government environments. In commercial environments, we're seeing companies who want to have absolute security in their data halls because they promised their customers that their data centers are going to be absolutely secure, and there's going to be no way for data to get out except by the customer-approved method. And so they can't allow any devices in there, and they use Bastille to detect whenever a device comes in or whenever a device gets turned on any place in the data center. They get a location within 6 feet, and somebody can go in there and find that device and get it out. So those are the two quite typical examples. In the military, one organization is actually using it to help our soldiers understand what their radio frequency footprint is. So when the soldiers are out on maneuver, they deploy one of our portable kits, and then they go back and show the commanding officer of that platoon, here's what we saw in terms of radio signals coming off your soldiers. Sometimes you see a Fitbit or a Phoenix Garmin watch. Those are very common. There are now shoes and hiking boots with Bluetooth in them. And that, you know, they're there for health. They measure how hard your footfall is, et cetera. But from the point of view of an enemy, that's like wearing a flare on your head. They can, using their own radio detection systems, they can see you coming because they see your radio frequency signal coming. And especially with advanced operators, they don't want, the U.S. citizens don't want our advanced operators detected in the field, and they're using Bastille to help those operators see what kind of radio signal their platoon is putting out. So there are applications for the military. There are applications keeping people or keeping devices out of secure areas. And then there are applications in enterprise where they want to know either has somebody brought a phone into the boardroom and now turned it on, or has somebody brought a device into a data center where no devices are allowed.
Okay, excellent. Now, how is the Bastille addressing the pain points of radio frequency technologies?
Well, so the biggest pain point in radio frequency is it's totally silent and it's totally invisible. And we solve that in a couple of ways. The main one is that our field people often tell the customers, we're the dots on a map company. So we get a floor plan of your facility, and we make visible where every device is because we put a dot on a map, and that dot can have colors depending on lots of different variables, what network it's connected to. Sometimes some customers actually want it to have the dot to have the initial of the person that was authorized to carry the device. So you see a B over there, and you know that's Bob's laptop, and you see a C in one corner, and you know that that's Cheryl's iPod. And so the first thing is we make the invisible visible by showing you where every transmitter is in your facility. But in addition to that, often people want to know, when they have a suspicious device, where has that device been in my facility? So the same screen which shows you where every device is on the floor is actually like a digital video recorder, and you can run it back in time and follow the device back through the last day, the last week, however long you want. You can see exactly where that device has traveled in your facility. So you know not only what it's doing right now, but what it has been doing, or where it has been, at least. And that helps people with forensic investigations, because another thing that does is, since that's a time-stamped view of where the device was, you can connect it to the information you're getting from your cameras and actually see who was in all those areas at all those times in order to figure out what was the prelude to some incident that you're investigating.
Okay,
now, we aren't in the camera business. Yeah. We aren't in the camera business. Huh? We just provide an API, an application programmer's interface, that lets us connect to everybody else's APIs so we can integrate with lots of other systems, network security systems, physical security systems, and camera systems.
Excellent. Now, your API, was the source code developed in-house, or was it outsourced? Just out of curiosity.
Absolutely, we have to do all of this stuff in-house, certainly our government customers insist that it all be done by U.S. citizens, we did it all in-house, at least in part because nobody else was working on this problem. You know, I mentioned earlier that we have 27 patents. One of the things that surprised me, because I've been in a lot of technology companies, is usually when you file for a patent, you make 35 claims of the different things you think you've invented in that patent, and the patent examiner comes back to you and says, you know, I think there's 17 of these claims which are either in are touched on by somebody else's patent or in the prior art, and so I'm disallowing 17 of those claims, and you end up with, you file 35 claims and you end up with 15. That were allowed by the patent examiner. With six of our patents, and by the way, the process takes a couple of years to get approved. With six of our patents, we've ended up getting approval on the first patent office action. So as we submit it, we've got our 35 claims, and 6 months to 9 months later, they come back and say, yep, those are all good claims, and the patent gets issued. So we are clearly working in an area that nobody else is working, because you wouldn't get patents with no arguments on all your claims if you were in an area where it was a crowded space and there's lots of people who might claim similar ideas. So we're working in this completely new area, which means we had to write our own API. Now, our VP of engineering is very religious about having an API which is going to be useful to other people that want to integrate to it. So he insisted that we write all our user interfaces by using our own API. Lots of times companies write an API that they publish to the world, but they have a secret API that they use themselves that includes shortcuts and things. We don't do that. Everything that we show our customer is written against our API. So presumably, if you wanted to rewrite what we had, you could do it in your own choice of design language and still get the same data, because it accesses the data the same way our user interface access to the data through the API. So it's a very good way to do integration. Go ahead.
Yeah, the reason I ask about that is because, you know, APIs and source code, they're a huge source of vulnerabilities, you know, with the cyber attacker. So,
yes.
Yeah, anyway.
There certainly are, and we spend a lot of time thinking about that. The great thing about being in a security company is you have a bunch of truly paranoid, security-oriented people in the organization who help you think a lot about where could this go wrong. So we're very careful about that. Now, we've done a lot of API integrations. We've done an API integration with Aruba. We've done an API integration with Cisco, an API integration with Palo Alto Networks. They have a product called Demisto. We've integrated to that. So we've got a lot of integrations out there already with other security vendors because security is a team sport. No one company can do it all alone. So you've got to have a way to work together with the other people that are also generating information about different kinds of security events.
True. As I said, it takes the village, right?
Yeah.
Anyway.
It does.
So now, I mean, Chris, we know that, you know, iPhones, Androids, you know, mobile security, that's has always been one of the hot button topics and will continue to be that. People have always thought the iPhones, iOS were much more secure than the Android, but they're starting to show some vulnerabilities too. Can you kind of expand on this, on these vulnerabilities and why no smartphone can be trusted?
Sure. Well, you know, there's no question that Apple has always been very concerned about customer privacy and data security on their phones. This is not to say that Android hasn't, but Apple certainly built a reputation there and spends a lot of money on it. The challenge is when you write an operating system that has millions of lines of code, there are all these subsystems that have to be plugged together. And when they are plugged together, you get the connections you expected, but you sometimes get another connection that you didn't expect, or a timing interaction, or something else which leaves a little vulnerability. Now, recently, but for the last few years, we've been hearing about a product called Pegasus, which comes from an Israeli company called NSO. And Pegasus is spyware that gets installed on somebody's phone. And once it's installed on somebody's phone, it can do lots of different things. It's essentially got the same rights to the phone as you do. So it can do anything you do. If you can read an encrypted message, because, of course, it has to be decrypted on your phone to read it, then it can read that decrypted message. If you can look up on GPS where you were last week, it can look up on GPS where you were last week. So it can do anything you can do on your phone, including listen into your phone calls. And it can also do things like turn on your phone or turn on the microphone and camera in your phone so that it can join you and listen in on a meeting. Now, we've known about Pegasus for a couple of years, but just in the last 6 months, the Pegasus Project, which is a group of 50 journalists, got together to figure out who were the victims of Pegasus. And they found a bunch of them, including the president of France and four of his chief ministers, journalists around the world, dissidents around the world, business leaders around the world have all been spied on by Pegasus. But what really was shocking in the last 6 months is that Pegasus has now advanced to the point that you don't have to make a mistake to get Pegasus installed. It used to be you had to trick somebody into clicking on a link or, you know, you send them a text message that has a link in it and they click on it. And organizations could find comfort in the theory that we trained our people not to make mistakes and click on links, so we're safe. Now, of course, people were still making mistakes, but they could say that to themselves. But that's no longer true, because Pegasus has been discovered to have zero-click capability, which means it can send you an iMessage, and then that iMessage empowers itself to install Pegasus on your phone. Even though you never see the message, you never get a notification, it just shows up and then authorizes itself to install itself on your phone. And so the good thing about Pegasus, if there is a good thing, is that Pegasus is an Israeli NSO that makes Pegasus is an Israeli company, and because of their relationship to the Israeli government and the friendship with the United States, they have said they won't track any phones with U.S. phone numbers. And that's fine. But they will track foreign phones in U.S. markets, because that's been shown to have happened. But interestingly, Pegasus gets all the press, but there are dozens and dozens of spyware companies. In fact, there are so many spyware companies, they formed a trade association called the Intellexa Alliance. So just like every other, you know, dairy farmers have an association, so do spyware makers. And of those dozens of companies, some are in China, some are in Russia. There's lots of places which may not care about their relationship to the United States in the same way that Israel does. And even if those companies didn't know how to do zero-click before, they're working on it now, because once somebody demonstrates it's possible, you know, if you were a hacker, you wouldn't want to waste a year trying to figure out how to do zero-click if there was no chance it would ever work. But once Pegasus has demonstrated you can do zero click, now it's worth your time to try to figure out how to do it. So you can expect all these other spyware companies to do it. And Pegasus, the NSO, is very expensive, millions of dollars a year. They sell primarily to governments. But for $100, you can buy spyware that a jealous spouse can install on her spouse's phone when he's in the shower or something. And there's a whole range of spyware in between those two. And you can bet the low-end ones are trying to add features of the high-end ones. So maybe last year, the only company that could do that cost millions of dollars to buy that technology. But this year, you can bet there are five of them, and they're getting cheaper and cheaper. And spyware is going to be available to everybody very soon. Which means every phone could have spyware on it. And, you know, you've been around the business long enough to know, to have heard a lot about insider threat, which we heard a lot about 10 years ago or 20 years ago. And what that used to mean was the disgruntled employee, or the employee that was in the also an employee of a foreign intelligence service or a competitor. It no longer means that. Now the insider threat is the loyal employee who's carrying a compromised phone. And by the way, that might be you. Even if you're the CEO of the company, you're loyal. But if your phone has been compromised because you walked down the street or sat in a Starbucks with it and somebody remotely installed spyware on your phone, you're now carrying that device into meetings, and it can be listening in on any meeting. And some people say, well, that's okay, I'll turn my phone off. But you know that a modern smartphone is never off. It's just in a different state, a different software state. And just like the Pegasus can look over your shoulder, it can reach in and turn your phone back on. And the reason that's interesting is, if I'm a spyware guy, probably I'm going to think the most interesting time to turn your phone on is 10 minutes after you've turned it off. because there's some reason you decided to turn it off. And then I really want to hear what you're saying. So there is a, you know, we're entering a world now where every phone could be a spy phone. And that means that there are certain parts of your facility or certain times when you want to make sure you don't have any phones in there. You know, you got to have a conversation about tomorrow's earnings report. You can't just say, well, let's turn off our phones. You got to say, let's leave all the phones outside this room and go in there and have a conversation about tomorrow's earnings report. And so that's what's changed, is that there could be zero-click installs on any phone anywhere, and we can't trust any of our phones the way we used to. Now, we're not going to get rid of them because they're too damn useful, but there are times and places where you have to have critical conversations, sensitive conversations about, for instance, a merger target. And when you do those conversations, you need to have no phones in the room.
Now, tell us about your partnership with the DHS, Department of Homeland Security. Can you kind of do a deep dive into that for us?
Sure. So I mentioned earlier that the government was more sensitive to radio frequency threats than industry was. But back in 2016, Department of Homeland Security put out a request for proposal for ways to detect RF threats, not only in the government, but also in critical infrastructure. You know, our power stations, our water plants, and other things, critical threats driven by radio frequency. And so Department of Homeland Security put out this proposal. It was honestly the most visionary document we have seen from anybody about the kind of threats that would exist, especially as we deploy more and more Internet of Things devices, almost all of which are connected by radio. And they actually got some help from the Stanford Research Institute in thinking about what these threats ought to be. It was a great document, and it was a document which in many ways described what we as a company wanted to do. So we made a proposal to respond to the questions in that document to build technology that would do that. And Department of Homeland Security gave us a few $100,000 a year for 4 years to build out more sophisticated versions of our product that accomplished the issues that they were concerned about. And when that was done, they introduced us to many different parts of the government and to also some commercial customers who might want to take advantage of our capabilities. And in addition to that, they provided us a vehicle that allows government agencies to buy our product in a single-sourced way. That is, they've already done the comparisons with other people's products, and they've said, for these purposes, this is a product that beats the competition, and you should buy it. And here's a vehicle where you can, there's, government has this strange concept of a vehicle, which is a certain form of agreement between the company and the government, which agencies can say, okay, I've got $2 million and I want to buy some Bastille product, I will put it through this vehicle. I'll buy Bastille through this agreement. And so we have an agreement with Department of Homeland Security, which makes it easier for Homeland Security agencies, but also other agencies to buy our product through Homeland Security. We have some other vehicles as well. We're on the GSA contract. We're on the so-called SEWP contract, that's S-E-W-P. That's NASA's vehicle for buying things. And but we have one with Homeland Security. They've been a great supporter and a visionary supporter of the work we've been doing.
Excellent. Now, Chris, I'm going to kind of segue out of Bastille for just a few moments and kind of get your take on some of the other cyber issues that are, you know, impacting our industry. And the first one I want to talk to you about is what they call the Internet of Things. You know, that's
sure.
where things all connect together. Excuse me. I find the proposition of the IoT to be very scary. It just opens up more mm-hmm. backdoors for the cyber attacker. I don't have a smart home. I don't have a smart car or anything like that. In fact, I still drive an 03 Honda Civic with the analog instrumentation. what are your thoughts on IoT? I'm very old-fashioned. In fact, I don't even have any mobile apps on my iPhone. What are your thoughts on the IoT? I just think it's just too scary. Do you have a smart home or a smart car?
Well, I have a Tesla, and so it's pretty clever. I can tell you there are parts of the government that won't let a Tesla on campus because that's just too much observation power. You know, if you look at all those cameras and all those sensors and things, they just won't let them inside the fence. And interestingly enough, in China, that's also true. China has a lot of secure facilities where they won't let Tesla drivers bring their car. So it is interesting that you have, as you say, a 2003 Honda and no apps and no smart no smart home devices. My most security conscious employees, you know, our real security experts, approach their life very much like you do. And I know some venture capitalists who have huge amounts of money and have no online accounts because they know enough about security to know they don't want to expose their accounts online. So I think you're showing a lot of wisdom there. That you're absolutely right about the IoT in two important ways. The first is there are going to be billions of these devices, and so that makes the attack surface much larger. The second thing is certainly the first generation of all these devices is being optimized not for security, but for battery life, because people don't want to change the batteries in these. They want things that will run 5 years on a AAA battery on a rooftop somewhere. And for that reason, they don't put in an encryption chip, because you have to spend battery power to run an encryption chip. They'd rather send it in the clear or with just a little bit of obfuscation. And those things are incredibly vulnerable. They're being cranked out fast, and you're always late to market, and the last thing you want to do is hold up the product in order to put in some more pieces of software security. So they ship. And so you've got a lot of product out there using a lot of new protocols. Many of these products have invented their own radio protocol to be more battery efficient. But, of course, we've got products like Wi-Fi and Bluetooth that have been around 10 or 15 or 20 years. And those things have vulnerabilities that are still being discovered. So you take a brand new protocol that somebody just invented for their sensor, and it's bound to have vulnerabilities that haven't been discovered yet, and hackers are going to be looking for them. You know, earlier I mentioned software-defined radios, which we leverage, but hackers are also leveraging software-defined radios. You can buy lots of hacking tools for $100. You can actually buy a software-defined radio for $20 on eBay, and it doesn't do what our $1,000 software-defined radios do. But it does a hell of a lot for $20, which means that any 17-year-old kid can be an RF hacker now, and they are going to be using those devices, learn everything they can about vulnerabilities in IoT devices and IoT sensors. And yes, you have good reason to be scared, and fortunately, a lot of people are thinking about it, but it is a very good reason to be scared. because there will be vulnerabilities discovered and people will have their networks penetrated from their IoT devices, and also just attacks on the IoT devices. It's very easy to imitate an IoT device that's communicating by radio frequency of some sort, and just send false information back. You know, send back that the temperature in the tank is 102 instead of 62. And there are very few protocols out there that really fingerprint the transmitter and know the one that's giving me information right now isn't the one that's supposed to be giving me that information. So it's easy to pretend to be a source of information that you're not.
Okay.
So, IoT.
The next,
scary as hell. Yeah.
Yeah. The next one I want to talk to you about is artificial intelligence. I just wrote a book that came out in print in February on artificial intelligence, and in that book I covered topics on computer vision, neural networks, machine learning. AI is a big buzzword that's being banged about in cybersecurity, and a lot of vendors are using that as a marketing ploy, I think, kind of unethically also, in order to get customers to buy their products. Does Bastille make use of AI for your products?
We make use of some machine learning. We don't make use of AI. What's the title of your book, by the way?
It's called Practical AI for Cybersecurity.
Great. Okay, thanks. I think I'll want to pick it up. So that's exciting.
Oh, thank you.
So AI is a blessing and a curse. What AI is believed to be good at, and a lot of people claim it, and some people accomplish it, AI can look at a lot of data flowing back from network devices, especially on the wire. We see more of it on the wire than in RF at this point. But AI can look at all that and say, oh, this data looks normal, but this data point is a little weird. It's an anomaly, and highlight it for somebody else. Usually, at some point, a human gets involved and says, you know, no, that's not an anomaly. I happen to know that somebody was there on Tuesday afternoon, and that one's okay. Some people say, well, okay, we're going to use AI to detect anomalies, and then we're going to act on it. We're going to disconnect that device from the network because it acted strangely. Now, there's no doubt AI that can do that very well, but there's a hell of a lot of AI that does it like a bull in a china shop. And you actually have production disruptions because the AI thought it saw an anomaly and that was unusual, but in the normal range, but it still cut off that machine controller from the rest of the system. So AI is definitely going to be important. It's less good than it thinks it is at this point, and it will also be a source of vulnerabilities because now you've got an attack surface that thinks in a way you don't even understand as the design engineer. You know, it's making up its own rules as it learns from the data. And people will learn to trick AI in ways that create vulnerabilities.
Wow. Okay. Now, my next question to you is, in the government sector, the CMMC is one of the big things being kind of played around right now. Do you have to come to CMMC compliance for the stuff that you do for the government?
We have so many compliance requirements for things we do for the government, and that's not the end of them. You know, in addition to those, the military has its own requirements, and the intelligence community has its own requirements, and we've got people that spend full time just making sure we're in compliance with all these things. And some of them are quite strange. We have an accreditation we're working on right now, which insists we develop our own encryption protocol for whenever we do a particular kind of transmission. And that is a transmission we never do, but we're still required to develop the encryption protocol for it because that's just the way the rule was written. And it turns out not to be an argument that we don't do it. They still want it there in the product. So there are, it's, you know, all bureaucracies are challenged, and I'm not saying this one is worse than others. I'm sure there are countries where it's much worse, but even the U.S. government has some rules which certainly don't make a lot of sense to a relatively small developer compared to the, maybe it makes sense to Boeing, because Boeing is working on so much stuff at once that somewhere in all their stuff, they have that need for that transmission. The fact that we don't, it bothers us a lot that we've got to distract engineers from important work in order to do work which we know is never going to be used.
Right. Now, last issue here is the COVID-19 remote workforce. As we know, COVID-19, I mean, it's not going to go away. It's going to be like the flu. And the remote workforce, we never thought that the 99% remote workforce would happen so quickly. We thought that this would happen maybe 4 or 5 years down the road. How has this impacted your business and your clients?
Well, in several ways. The first one is, yes, we switched almost immediately to a remote workforce, and but we have offices. There are many days when there's nobody in the office and a few days when there's one person in the office who's come in to restart a machine or install some new hardware or whatever, but we don't have any gatherings in the office anymore. We meet over video conferencing. And for our company, it has been a boon to productivity. People are more productive.
Really?
I'd say there are fewer meetings, and that maybe makes them more productive. They're in their home environments, which somehow they've managed to engineer so that they aren't as distracted as one might fear from kids and pets and spouses and all that. They've worked it out. I don't know how, but they have. And as a function of that, we've been very pleased with how much productivity our engineers are accomplishing. It's also been helpful for our salespeople, because there are certainly lots of government and enterprise facilities that aren't letting anybody in anymore. So they're taking more conversations over Zoom or Google Meet or one of the other video conferencing systems, which means you don't have to fly to them. You don't have to drive to them. They don't want to see you anyway except over Zoom. And so our salespeople are losing less time in travel and spending more time in substantive conversations. That's been good. Now, it's not always true. We certainly have had situations where a colonel somewhere says, I'm not buying this product until a salesman standing here explaining to me how he's going to take care of it after it's installed, in which case salespeople have gone to see colonels. But overall, it's been, I'd say, a net productivity improvement for us. And for the customer, what's changed is you might have gone to see a customer and there were two people in the room, and then you had to hope they told other people. But, you know, we were on a Zoom presentation a few weeks ago where we expected 8 people and maybe 50 showed up from the different parts of a big government agency. So we're actually able to reach farther into organizations than we were before COVID, because everybody's calling in from home. They're not actually in the office busy with other things. They show up at our meetings.
Okay, that's
right. But I, by the way, I totally agree with you. It's going to be with us. COVID's going to be with us forever, and these remote working is going to be with us forever because, at least in our case, it's been a net boon.
Right. Well, yeah, my book will hopefully be out in print next spring. It's going to be a CISO's like pandemic how-to guide of what to do better next time. Because COVID really hit us hard. And a lot of people were not prepared for it, especially from the DR and incident response planning standpoint. So I've kind of given a book on how to do all that better in case, like, the bubonic plague comes out or something, hopefully not like that. But just to get the CISO ready, what to do better next time. Now,
I think it's absolutely clear that we're going to see other pandemics, and I hope everybody does better next time and understands the seriousness of exponential growth, because that's what we missed.
Well, I mean, I have my views on the whole thing started, but I'll keep politics aside. Anyway, so as we start to wrap up our show, Chris, you know, ransomware has been the biggest hot-button variant today. I mean, there not goes one headline where there's not this one ransomware attack, blah, blah, blah. What do you think is going to happen in 2021? What do you think the worst cyber threat is going to be?
Oh, for 2021, it's still going to be ransomware. And ransomware happens because very few people take cyber security sufficiently seriously. And so they leave lots of vulnerabilities. And as a function of those lots of vulnerabilities, ransomware finds lots of ways to exploit them. You know, taking another example, Bastille actually had an interesting experience several years ago when one of our security guys Googled his girlfriend. He was in our Atlanta office. He Googled his girlfriend and found her on the election rolls on the Atlanta state voter registration rolls, and he found that those were PDFs on a website. So he could pull all the voter registration rolls from this website, and which was part of the state server for voting. And he also found that he could provide new PDFs if he wanted, so he could change voter registration rolls. And he also found the place where the software was left so that the voting machines were air-gapped, but yeah, you took a little thumb drive and to update the software, you took a little thumb drive, plugged it into the server system, and downloaded the new image of the voting machine software, and then you carried the voting machine and plugged it in, and he found he could have, he didn't, but he could have provided new voting machine software to all the voting machines. And he told the election agencies about it, then the state government, and everybody ignored him until it got published in Wired, and then it was a big scandal, and fortunately, Georgia completely cleaned up its voting system in time for the last elections. But it was it was the same thing. That is, people had not taken security seriously. Security is always hard. It's always a pain in the ass. You know that. You've written books on it. And so people often take shortcuts. Here's an interesting one. There's a Zigbee is the way you control buildings, and you know software, the wireless protocol that controls buildings. After we'd done a bunch of installations, one of my engineers noted to me, we'd never seen a building where Zigbee was encrypted, and which means that essentially anybody could jump into your building control system and turn off the card readers at the front door or whatever. if they were just clever enough and energetic enough about it. And why don't they encrypt it? Because then you've got all the problems of making sure everybody has the right password in order to run the building. And, you know, if the password gets compromised or needs to be changed, you got to tell them all again. It's a big pain. So people solve it by not encrypting. And in the same way, people solve their nuisance problems by not making them secure. And then ransomware is going to come in and exploit it. And, you know, we've seen it happen a zillion times. We're going to see it happen a zillion times more. And fortunately, that will make people more worried about security. But unfortunately, it's going to mess up a lot of people's lives and hospital records and other things in the meantime.
Okay. Do you have any final thoughts on today's show, Chris? What's the best way for someone to get a hold of you in case they're interested in your services?
Well, I think they should go to www.bastille.net, and there's, of course, a way to get a hold of us there. But more important, there are on the Bastille.net site, there's lots of information about use cases, applications for different kinds of organizations, and examples of the case studies and other things that I talked about a little bit today. So I'd say go to www.bastille.net, take a look around. There's ways to reach out to us on there. And from there, also on there, we give a lot of webinars about RF vulnerabilities. And those webinars are both live. You're welcome to attend free online. And also, they're available on the website, so you can look at ones we've done in the past to learn things about the vulnerabilities that we see and are concerned about. And those webinars are usually done by our chief technology officer, Dr. Bob Baxley, who's much smarter about this stuff than I am.
Okay. Well, Chris, we thank you for your time this afternoon. We look forward to having you on future podcasts. That was the first one I've ever had one on spun radio frequency and had to be used for security purposes.
Yeah, great. Well, I enjoyed it too. And yeah, we'll come back in later and talk about whatever's new in radio frequency, because it's an area that's evolving all the time. Thank you.
Thanks. Have a great rest of the weekend.
You too. Bye.